We apologise that the beginning of this question and answer session is missing, but we pick it up about 10 minutes in.
I'm just not in tune with the fulfilment of the commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's what we're made for. And so having been completely caught by Edwards on that, I then read his The End for Which God Created the World, which you just don't ever read chapter one of that, unless you must, because it's pretty difficult. Chapter two is wonderful, where he has a look through the story of glory in the Bible. And I saw how beautifully glorious God is. And so I came to agree with Edwards that God could be and is my treasure, not heaven itself. Mm. So that I could be with what Paul's saying in Philippians 1. It's not my desire is to depart and be in heaven. It's my desire is to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Mm. He's my treasure. And heaven is only heaven because of him.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We were watching an interview with Philip Jensen recently, and he was talking about in student ministry that he always tackles, first of all, predestination. And he said, and the reason he does it, he said, because it's the doctrine that gets people to see that the gospel is not human-centered. Mm. God's plan is not human-centered. It's God-centered. He says, so he starts there. He said, because that is the revolution.
Yeah.
In people's minds. And I see that time and time again in ministry. And it is like a second conversion when that happens to you and that grips you. So you become a Christian, you have these informative times. What about, when did the thought start coming in that you wanted to be in? There's this phrasing that people use, full-time paid gospel ministry set aside by a call or something like this long extended thing so that no one jumps on your back and reminds you that everybody is in ministry. So when did that happen for you and how?
right in this crisis, actually. So I, having seen solid answers, I developed a taste for knowing God better, knowing his gospel better, knowing his word better. I developed an appetite for it that I hadn't had before. And I also saw, I don't want other people to go through what I went through. There are robust answers. And if I can possibly help people to be able to not only avoid the despair of faithlessness, which is where I'd been, but also know the joy of knowing God. Mm. If I can help people with that, great. And I think from then on, it was just a question of where exactly do I go? And I was torn between, am I a theologian or a pastor? And I've always kind of felt both. And therefore, struggled to know exactly how to work that out. Mm. But I've always wanted to be both a theologian and a pastor. I've always wanted to see theology never as a game, but always driving mission, always building up the saints. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, on that, and I don't want to be in danger of bringing back the great Reeves from the grave, who no doubt always lives with you, but one of the things that I personally have experienced whenever you teach or reading your books is that you do take those things and make them accessible to people, but make loving God and the joy and delight of being in Christ. It's so wonderfully displayed in the talks that you give and in your books. So can you tell me a little bit, particularly focusing on, you've mentioned a few figures from church history. You've obviously got a book on the Reformation. Why did you want to write on those particular things, and what do you think we can gain from them? I know what I gained from them, that there may be some people out there who have not read The Unquenchable Flame. And, and because obviously you put them in such an accessible way. But obviously, so give us, sell why the Reformation still matters to us. Obviously, you've got that book out now.
Do you know, I think there are about 8 questions in there, actually.
You choose the one that you must like.
Yeah, I might just answer, do that. A few different... See, the first one is, as a theologian, I think a sort of life text would be 2 Corinthians 4, 4 to 6. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So, as a theologian, as a pastor, this is my job. This is what I delight to do, which is not simply to give light into darkness. It is to give the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And so I want people not simply to comprehend ideas, but through their minds being enlightened, to see the glory, the beauty, the majesty of Jesus. And therefore, to dully convey information is not faithful. Mm. And I think when I wrote the first book, I think something that was on my mind a bit was I felt a little bit aggrieved at some evangelical writing, that it could just be a bit dull.
What was the first book? Was that Unquenchable?
It was The Unquenchable Flame.
Yeah. On the sausages and, what was it? Sausages and, I remember a chapter about sausages.
And soldiers. Or
sausages and soldiers, that was it, yeah.
And, don't ask me.
I love sausages, so.
that's the bit that stuck. But I thought, how can we talk about these glorious things in dull ways? We have no right to do that. We must talk about the beautiful gospel and our beautiful God and convey that beauty as best as we possibly can. That's part of being faithful. So why the Reformation stuff? Well, the Reformation book, my own experience of Luther and the boys, had transformed my life. I'd seen clarity on the gospel from no one else like with Luther. So I really wanted to share that. And is this being recorded?
Okay. Let's record everything nowadays. Just so you
know. I won't say the next bit.
All right, don't say the next bit. Tell me later. That's it. They all want to know now. That's the problem. So everyone's trying to pretend, I'm a Christian minister. It doesn't really bother me what I was going to say, but everybody really wants to know what you're going to say.
I'll say it in a particular way. One of the things I wanted is, so with The Unquenchable Flame, I wanted it to be a bedtime read that you could just enjoy reading and feel this is just a story. I wanted it to be the sort of story you could give to a non-Christian friend and go, look, it's just a history book. Safe as houses, what could go wrong? But actually, you're getting the gospel through it. Yeah. So you're feeling, I'm actually maybe even enjoying this read, this history, goodness. But I'm also picking up the gospel through it. The next one, the Why the Reformation Still Matters. This was, the idea was that in 2017, which is going to be the 500th anniversary of the Reformation is probably going to be in the media quite a bit, but almost certainly in a negative way. We'll hear the BBC saying, isn't it a shame that Christians are divided, and over things that, you know, no longer divide us anymore, do they? Wouldn't it be nice if we could all be in agreement? And I think there's quite a proactive policy in Rome at the moment of trying to show that the Reformation is over. So Pope Francis has been very intelligent in fostering that sort of message, that while he's written academic papers calling Luther and Calvin blasphemous heretics, he doesn't say that in public. So in public, he's talked about Protestant brothers. And it looks like what we're seeing is a movement towards, apparently there's a document that he has that he'd like to sign, which is backing up the 1999 declaration, the joint declaration on justification by faith, which the Roman Catholic Church did in 1999 with the Lutheran World Federation, which said there's now agreement, basic agreement on the doctrine of justification. And apparently in 2017, Pope Francis looks like he's going to say that's absolutely right. Therefore, the Reformation is over. Brother Martin, your struggle is done. And so, Tim and I wanted to have a book that would not be sort of hot prot Catholic bashing, but that would just look at some of the key doctrines of the Reformation. So, sola scriptura, justification by faith, grace, sin, union with Christ, and on. And just written for ordinary people to say, look, here's what the Roman Catholic Church was saying, here's what the Reformers were saying, that is a significant difference, and what the Reformers are saying here is really life-changing and worth hanging on to. I could go through all of those doctrines and show why now if you wanted.
People wouldn't buy the book then, wouldn't they? And I know you're not concerned whether they buy Piper's books, they can watch the interviews, but we want them to buy yours. It might have been last year, we started chatting as a staff team about a new initiative, so Union Theology. Although I must tell you that the first time I read the first logo that came out, I thought it said onions. And I thought it was about theology having many layers and about Shrek and all that. I nearly signed it myself, even though I've done theology. But so tell us a little bit about that, where that came from, what it is, and where it's heading.
Yeah. So my ministry now is heading up Union. Union School of Theology, we've got now 15 locations around the place. So we've got a campus, we've got a headquarters in Oxford, we've got a campus in Wales where you can do your full-time, classic, old-style, full-time, campus-based theological education. But one of the things that had been building on my mind for a while was that while such a thing is good, and we'll keep having it, it is very expensive. And the danger is that that's a bottleneck on the growth of the church. And if we want to see the church grow, we must raise up robust, wise, godly leaders who are theologically educated and strong in themselves and spiritually strong. But because, historian hat on, this is how the Puritan movement died out. They were banned from Oxford and Cambridge in the 1660s. By 1700, they've got no theological muscle left, and the movement's dead. And my fear is we're going to see the same in evangelicalism. That without having a robust raising up of leaders, we're going to see in the next generation an increasingly superficial, flaky leadership. Good-hearted, but they won't be so theologically robust, which means that, well, what happened to the successors of the Puritans was they became flaky, flimsy, and heretical. So we need to look at how to raise up leaders. But what I wanted to look at was how do you do that without being a bottleneck on the church? Because you need to have some way to have a quality theological education to spiritually form, educate leaders, and for it not to cost your church £70,000. So how do you do that? So we came up with a model of learning communities where you have a few people can study together in a local church or a collection of local churches where we can bring in the theological education, all mentored by a local church pastor, and it's all done at fifth of the price or something, so that you can have a robust theological education where you are with a price stripped right back with people doing their theological education while they're in ministry. And so what I would like to see is these learning communities spread out locally in city centres and in rural locations where churches feel, let's use these learning communities to raise up leaders and make them be church planting hubs, multiplication models, bring students in, train them up, and send them out as church planters. That's what we're trying to do.
Great. Can I ask you on that? So you talked about the Puritans and them not having that. Your model, has it been seen before in the church's history? So do you look at any period of times and think, actually, this was in existence, sort of, or is it just something that's available because of the advances in technology or...
Some of the particular ways it works are, you know, we've got advances in technology, we've got a financial pressure on us at the moment. We need to make something that's quality, but financially accessible and geographically accessible. But it has been done before. And so the model that's been on my mind really has been John Calvin's Geneva. So John Calvin, in 1555, set up his academy in Geneva. And what he did was he raised up leaders in Geneva. He prepared resources for them. Printing became the dominant industry in Geneva, the dominant industry in the city of Geneva, as evangelical resources were being published. These men who were raised up were then sent out through networks that were set up, particularly in France, but elsewhere as well. They went to Italy, Norway, Scotland, even to Brazil. Men went out from Geneva. And they went out in pretty big numbers, such that by the 1560s, you were seeing thousands of churches planted in France, new churches. There was a massive wave of church planting, led very often by these strong, educated leaders who had resources with them. And so by 1562, you had in France about 2,100 or so new churches. Mm-hmm. And in the 1560s, something like close to 3 million new converts in France. Mm-hmm. And it was a very orchestrated, rounded project to see, let's resource, let's raise, let's send Christian leaders for the sake of church planting. And that's really been the model in my mind.
Great.
So let's get on board with all the church planting activity that's going on and ensure we're fueling it with robust leaders.
Great. That sounds very exciting. I could sit and ask questions and listen to you all day. It's like being with your granddad by a warm fire on a cold winter day. Although not, obviously, more interesting and not as old. But it's one of those things where you can just stay here. You just feel so relaxed and enjoying it so much. But as the Ascension has taught me, I shouldn't be a selfish minister. So let's go to some questions from some other people. Do you want to start with one from the pile that was handed in?
Yeah.
Just read it out and then...
Is Acts 7 the only place where we learn about Jesus' standing ministry, as opposed to him being seated? Another example would be Revelation 5. There we see him standing. And again, it's within a context of suffering. So, in a suffering church, what we see in Revelation 5 is John sees the lion who is the only one with the authority to open the scroll and to guide history. So it's a key moment again of Jesus' compassion and his control over what's happening. So that's where standing seems to be used again in Revelation 5.
Yeah. Well, I remember reading this again. It was either one of the Puritans or English reformers about Acts 7 and saying that it was about, as well, the Son of Man who has ascended, welcoming those that he's purchased. Mm. And what do you think about that? Because your emphasis with John Bunyan was on him pleading and speaking. Do you think that there's some merit in that? Or
I think there can be in that. In all those cases of standing, it's about him not being apathetic towards his people. Mm. He's proactively compassionate and strongly active for them. So welcome would come into that as well.
Yeah. Great. Who's got the mic? And are there any questions from the floor? Just raise your hand and then the mic will come out to you. Okay, at the back on the left, Steve. Thank you. Okay, just shout out the question.
There's a It's great to hear about union. I know there's sort of lots of different things around. I'm just wondering, I mean, it'd be helpful for me to know, and I'm sure there are others asking the same question. I mean, are there things that are distinctive about union, about Porterbrook Network, about the other things that mean somebody should choose one thing over another?
Yeah, absolutely. A few different things. I suppose one of the key things is the level we're talking about. So what I saw in what has been already available through Gospel Partnership and ministry training schemes and Porterbrook, for example, is great theological education and training at a particular level. But what we wanted to do is to provide the level up from that, the sort of thing that you get at a full-time theological college, and for it to be accredited. As one of the things about accreditation, some people care about accreditation, some don't. One of the things that's important for me in keeping accreditation is that we can offer PhDs and raise up the scholars of the next generation. And we're the only Reformed evangelical place in the UK that can do that. So I'm pretty keen to hang on to that. So it means that we can offer where people are that level up, and we know it's the level up because it all fits within the university guidelines as to what levels are. And accredited as such. So the level is a good bit of it. But there's also the emphasis on community. So one of the things about learning that I think is important is that it's one thing to download material and look at it in your bedroom. But for raising up pastors, On the one hand, it's good to do so among friends. Iron sharpens iron. You get to learn from each other. And that's one of the traditional benefits of a college, is that sort of corridor time of just being with fellow students. But also, if I'm actually to provide a reference for someone, if a church is saying, is this guy qualified to be our pastor? I simply cannot say that if he's just, basically he's ticked off the essays to do and he's, you know, he's passed everything, he's got his degree. I've never met the guy. I don't know whether the guy's a pastor. So we need to have communities where there is a pastor there, where you learn in community and there's real accountability there. So I think those are a couple of the key things. The level of which it's taught, which is unique, and the community way in which it's taught.
Very quick follow-up, if I may. Is it already accredited by certain denominations, or...?
It's Chester University accredited.
Thank you. The next question? Yeah, just here on the right, halfway back. Keep your hand in the air and then Jeff will come to you.
It's just a quick question about the king and the priest not in the same role. How does Solomon, with his seemingly priestly prayer with the temple, sort of fit that?
Solomon's an interesting character in being the son of David. In so many ways, he typifies Christ. And so there's something right about the fact that there is something almost priestly in being. As the son of David, he builds the temple. But still, it's not an overtly priestly role, and he's not allowed to have it. So yes, absolutely, there's something of that picked up because he's the son of David. But he can't actually offer the sacrifices and go into the Holy of Holies.
Yeah. Other questions just behind it? Yeah.
Just a quick question. You may have asked this already, in which case I'm sorry, and just back me down. But can you explain a bit about the link between adoption and the ascension? So what's the connection between them? Thank you for your comments about adoption. They're clear and so clearly applied. But what's the link?
Yeah. I think... A couple of passages to look at will be Psalm 2 and Hebrews 1. Sorry if I didn't make that clear enough. So Psalm 2 . Let's just dive in at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs at those who would oppose him. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. Right? So that's about Christ sitting down, having ascended, and he then sits down on the throne. I will tell of the decree, the Lord said to me, you are my son, today I've begotten you. And Hebrews 1 picks that up. And Hebrews 1 seems to be talking about a few different things, but ascension is clearly on the writer's mind. So Hebrews 1 verse 3, after making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Having become as much superior to angels as the name he's inherited is more excellent than theirs. For, hear the string of continuity of argument, for to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I've begotten you? So, when Christ sits down on the heavenly throne, it is of a piece with him being declared the son. And this keeps coming up through Hebrews. For example, in chapter 5. So also Christ, 5:5. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. So that session, the sitting of Christ in heaven, is inextricable from him being declared the Son. Now, of course, he was declared the Son eternally, and he was declared the Son at key moments in his ministry. But what's important about the declaration of the sonship of Jesus in his session in heaven is that when he is declared Son, it is something that's different to what's ever been before. Now, a man is being declared son and worthy of the throne. And that's never happened before. Does that make sense? What do you want to pick? Is that right? Yeah.
Any other questions? Matthew?
You'll know that Bishop John Robinson, amongst others, said that primitive people in New Testament times thought that the ascension was going vertically upwards into space. And he should have gone into orbit, but now we know that's not the case. I don't suppose anyone's particularly troubled by that, but could you explain the concept of ascension being going up and the fact that we can't follow him up in a rocket and find him? So therefore, what's going on, and explain how that fits together?
Bluntly, scientifically, no, I can't. I wish I could in some ways. And I think what that leads me to say is, on the one hand, what we see very clearly and unambiguously in Scripture is that Christ takes his body to heaven. If you can't understand where that is, you know that it is. So we've got a definite fact to hold on to. And we need to distinguish that from any attempts to explain how that might be. So people today tend to go for multi-dimension theory, for example. To be honest, I tend to think... Tom Wright, for example, tends to go for multi-dimension theory as he looks at heaven and earth intersecting. He sees them as different sorts of spaces, which is actually a medieval idea. But attempts to explain where Jesus' body is and how we can't reach it by going in a rocket have been made through the centuries, and each past century's attempt to explain it now seems rather laughable. So I think we should be highly wary of saying, with any degree of authority, say from the pulpit, I think it's multi-dimension theory. I think it's best to say, I just don't know how that works. But we do know, yes, he actually went up. And yes, he actually took his body with him. And his body is actually in heaven now. Beyond that, the details of how that is, I don't know. It's no surprise to me that I can't get there because of the cherubim. It's no surprise to me. I don't belong there. I only will belong there when he calls me, when I'm resurrected.
Would you see a connection with the with Paul's thing in 1 Corinthians 15 about the natural body and the spiritual body, and Jesus's and Augustine talks about this, how the resurrection body is a although it's the same body, it is transformed in a fundamentally different way. Do you see a connection with that, or is that just another we don't know?
Well, there is a connection there, given that it is his physical body that is transformed to be a spiritual rather than what's called a natural or soulish body. So it has been transformed, but it is the very body that was crucified and transformed in the resurrection and glorified. What that means for location and where he is, again.
Thank you. Next question. I think we've got time for one more. Behind you.
Oh, sorry, my phone's just stopped turning my phone off. Hebrews 9, verse 11, the second part of verse 11, not part of this creation. Mm-hmm. Well, he is, but the emphasis there is he's not part of this creation. He is in heaven, our flesh and blood. The emphasis there on not part of this creation. Can you help there? I think you moved on when you mentioned that.
Yeah, sure. In Hebrews, the contrast being made continually, which is simply picking up what was going on in Exodus, is the contrast between the earthly copy and the heavenly reality. So the way he explains it is, well, not of this creation means not made with hands. It's not down here. It's not saying it's not in the universe somewhere. It's not saying that. But it's not made with hands. It's not part of this world here. Because that's the contrast. We know it's not Jerusalem. It's not that earthly copy. It's the heavenly one.
We're going to wrap up to give ourselves 25 minutes break before I'm sure we'll have another fantastic time in the third session. It's been excellent so far, and I've found it personally very, very challenging and inspiring. So thank you.